believe with their lips, but whose hearts have no faith, albeit amongst the Jews, men who will listen to any lie, will listen even to others who have never so much as come to thee. They change the words from their times and places. They say, if you are given this, take it, but if not, beware. If anyone's trial is intended by Allah, thou hast no authority in the least for him against Allah. For such is not Allah's will to purify their hearts. For them there is disgrace in this world and a heavy punishment in the hereafter. So Muhammad didn't particularly love the Jews, as you can see. They are fond of listening to falsehood, of devouring anything forbidden. If they do come before thee, either judge between them or decline to interfere. If thou decline, they cannot hurt thee in the least. If thou judge, judge in equity between them, for Allah loves those who judge in equity. But why do they come to thee for decision when they have their own law before them? Therein is the command of Allah. Yet even after that they would turn away, for they are not really people of faith. It was we who revealed the law to Moses. Therein was guidance and light. By its standards, Jews have been judged by the prophets who bowed to Allah's will, by the rabbis and the doctors of law. For to them was entrusted the protection of Allah's book, and they were witnesses thereto. Therefore, fear not men, but fear me, and sell not my signs for a miserable price. If any do fail to judge by the right of what Allah has revealed, they are no better than unbelievers. So in short, after several derogatory remarks about the Jews, the law is laid down that the Jews are to adjudicate their own cases in their own courts according to their own laws. This was the Islamic position, and it had prevailed more or less up until the beginning of the 20th century. Let me just read a little bit further.
No, we're just discussing on the way here, and that's what I thought happened.
Perhaps even in contemporary law.
Perhaps. So, for example, here's a quote from Baron, from an 11th century Muslim writer. If there be quarrels amongst infidels with respect to their religion, or if their opinions be divided in regard to their religious principles, one must not interfere in their affairs or exercise any pressure upon them. If there be litigation among them, and they submit it to their own judge, one should not prevent them from doing so. If they should come, however, to our judge, he should judge them according to the laws of Islam and impose upon them, if they should prove guilty, such penalties such as are imposed in our law books. That's from an 11th century Islamic writer. And now here's a article by a 20th century Islamic writer in the book, this is by Professor Tian of Lebanon, in the book Law in the Middle East. The judge, Qadi, is essentially a naib, lieutenant, the delegate representative of the governor. He does not have an independent or even autonomous position. Whenever the governor or caliph appointed a judge, the latter could subdelegate power to a third party who could in turn delegate his powers and so on. In the course of time, the office of the Qadi took on a decidedly religious character, which steadily grew stronger and extended to all related institutions. Ibn Khaldun, in his enumeration of the religious functions of the caliph, mentions qada, justice, after prayer, and the futiya, legal interpretation. According to Ibn Khaldun's concept, which is representative of the classical doctrine, this characteristic of the judicial function stems from the religious character of the caliphate, whose essential mission is to apply to the sharia as it's laid down in the sacred texts. The Qadi's court was placed in the mosque. Shafi'i believed that the court should be placed elsewhere, but the Hanafis retorted that the mosque was certainly the best place since the rendering of justice was an act of devotion. Okay. Now, So the situation was that the Jews were a somewhat despised minority, but they had complete judicial autonomy, and in furthermore, turning to the non-religious courts meant, in the time of Islam, actually going to the mosque. I'll skip this a moment. Okay. So, for the first time in many, many years, when after the Islamic conquests, there was a very broadly based central Jewish authority, namely the Gaonim, who were living wherever, perhaps originally in Sura and Pampadita, eventually in Baghdad, who were issuing rulings for the entire Jewish community under Muslim control. Secondly, the economic situation changed. That is, the Jews, instead of being completely dependent upon agriculture as the principal of all, or almost the sole source of economic activity, began to become engaged in trade, in shipping, in various adventurous and dangerous shipping operations. So, for example, we find in the Midrash, whereas the Yerushalmi and Peah, citing the Takana of Usha that says that a man should never give more than one-fifth to charity, says that the minimum amount is 1 or 2%, like either a truma or trumat ma'aseh. In other words, the implication that charity should come from a source of income other than agriculture, where there was a biblical requirement of giving ma'aser, did not make sense in the Talmudic period. Whereas, if we take a look in the Medrash Tanchuma, aser ta'aser, aser b'shvil shetit aser, ad shelo tivchaser, you should give 10% of your money that in order that you become rich and not become poor. Remez lemafarshe yamim. It's a hint for those people who engage in shipping, who go down into the into shipping. Ve'lahotzi echad mi'asara la'amilei Torah. They should give 10% of their income to those who study in the yeshiva, in contrast to the Rambam's position. So we see that the Jews began to become involved in all different forms of commerce. Or it says, again, in Bereshit Rabbah, in the same period, Yeda Adam od et ishto, that Adam again had sexual congress with his wife, Nitosif lo ta'ava al tavato. He had a larger sexual appetite. L'sha'avar im lo haya ro'er lo haya mitaveh. When Eve was out of sight, she was out of mind. He had no sexual appetite. Now, whether or not he sees his wife, on occasion he has a desire for her. Rabbi Abba bar Yudin, the shame of Acha, remez lemafarshe yamim, sheyayunis karim et batehem uba'im miyad. That those who go down to the sea, in the ocean, in ships, occasionally remember home and then hurry back home in order to get their conjugal rights. And let me summarize from Professor Goitein. To sum up, during the High Middle Ages, which is still in this period that we're concerned with, from about the 6th century until around the 11th century or the 12th, to sum up, during the High Middle Ages, men, goods, money, and books used to travel far and almost without restriction throughout the Mediterranean area. In many respects, the area resembled a free trade community. The treatment of foreigners, as a rule, was remarkably liberal. The close connection among all parts of the Jewish diaspora, expressed in contributions to, and spiritual and organizational dependence upon, economical religious authorities in faraway countries, was not regarded by the governments of the various states concerned as an infringement on their sovereignty. How is all this to be explained? To a certain extent, by the fact that the machinery of the state was relatively loose in those days. That is, the technique of making life unbearable was not yet as perfected as it is in our own days. I love Professor Goita. I mean, his personal views come through without a doubt in his scholarly work. One should not, however, strain this point too much. There's plenty of evidence in the Geniza records, as well as in the Arabic sources, that the governments kept a vigilant eye on foreigners, and also that they often had opportunity to occupy themselves with the inner affairs of the non-Muslim communities. Officially appointed spies and secret police saw to it that visitors from foreign countries did not evade their customs duties and did not engage in any activity detrimental to the state. Quarrels between individuals and communal strife often invoked the intervention of the governments or their local officials. Thus, it was not so much the looseness of the machinery of the state as positive factors that contributed to the amazing degree of the freedom of movement and to the comparatively close unity of the Mediterranean world. At the root of all of this was the concept that law was personal and not territorial. An individual was judged according to the law of his religious community, or even religious school or sect, rather than that of the territory in which he happened to be. Perhaps it would be even more exact to say that, with the exception of some local statutes promulgated and abrogated from time to time, the states as such did not possess any law. These were the preserves of the religions and their various subdivisions. For Jews in Spain or France to seek high court decisions in Jerusalem or Baghdad, or later on with Maimonides and his successor in Cairo, was the normal and natural thing to do. It would hardly occur to an American judge of our own days to try to make a livelihood by exercising his profession while traveling around the globe. For nowhere outside the United States, nay, outside his own state in the U.S., would he be able to obtain an appointment. Ibn Battuta, however, the great Muslim traveler of the 14th century, made his way from Morocco to China and back while dispensing Maliki law. He also engaged in business as befitted a judge in those days. This is a brand of Muslim law which was widely accepted in North Africa, but comparatively rare elsewhere, and therefore a scholar of the caliber of Mutura was welcomed by the scattered Maliki communities engaged by them as a judge. Similarly, as we've seen, the Egyptian jury often procured its judges and other community officials from foreign and even very distant countries almost during the whole of the classical Gnesa period. And I'll come back to that a bit later. So we can see that in contrast to what was happening during the Persian and the Roman periods, where the state, for one reason or other, especially under Rome, instituted its own bodies of law, there was essentially no body of law other than religious law. It would have been completely out of line and unusual for a Jew who had a dispute with another Jew to turn to anybody but the Jewish judge, because there was the Islamic authorities, at least in the first instance, had no authority on them whatsoever. So when we're talking about the Takanat of the Gaonim, in complete contrast to what the Rambam was saying in his introduction, that somehow or other Jewish authority, which was centralized during the time of the Gemara, became dispersed and local after the time of Rabbeinu and Rav Ashi, the facts, in fact, are just the reverse. During the Gaonic period, under Islam, the Gaonim, eventually in Baghdad, had enormous authority over the entire Jewish community, except for the small scattered communities in northern Europe and so on, which were under perhaps Charlemagne rather than under Islamic control. Now, Mr. Weinstein wanted a tshuva in Arabic, so we will have Jonathan read this, which is an absolutely amazing response from Rav Haigon. We have it here, you've got it in the handout on page whatever it is. It's immediately after. Sure. He's going to read it in Arabic to us and translate it. Page 13. Yeah, go ahead.
What's the outline of Safatim? So you asked about the Safatim. These are promissory notes.
Bills of exchange, right?
And how they are to be handled judicially. If Reuven wrote Shimon, Safatijim in Balad ila Balad, if he wrote this bill of exchange from one country to another, Wa'arit ha Shimon ala Levi, and Shimon gave it unto Levi, Wakabal ha min ha Suman Kaha, and he received it, and then it's not clear who, but and then we met. Umen Aslam Wahua Makur Anho, whoever received it. If the if it's not paid, does Shimon then have to go back to Reuven, and then ask for the money of this bill of exchange? And if not, does Levi? Does Levi owe anything or not? Kadra Aina and Laisa fi, I don't know this next word, Fakana and Nawaji Sifadri Rakov Rabotenu. So we saw that, so the question is that according to the rabbis, En Mishalchim Ma'ot B'Yukni Vafil Eidin Chatumi L'Aleah. In other words, according to the rabbis,
one is not allowed, one should not, cannot send money by this means of promissory notes or bill of exchange, even with valid witnesses and so on.
So according to this, the third one would have a suit against the second, and the second against the first. The third person has no connection with However, we saw when we saw that people use these notes. Sir Nanachem Baha Laila, but it's probably Likaila Tabata Batara Jarat of Nas. We started using these in order to prevent the destruction of commerce. And so our method is to rule in them according to the law of merchants.
So this is an amazing shuvah. Rav Hagaon is eliminating the Talmudic law which doesn't recognize the transferability of debt or bills of exchange, and he says, because since we see that this is a method that's commonly used in business, we will replace in this matter Talmudic law by Hakam al-Tajar, the law merchant, and therefore in all Jewish courts bills of exchange will be regarded as legitimate instruments of business in order to promote an efficient commercial activity. Now, this is just absolutely amazing. I mean, here, even 300 or 400 years later, the Roman Catholic Church in its ecumenical law refused to admit the notion of the laws of exchange and insisted on old Roman law whereby a debt was personal. If Dr. Schwaber lends me some money, then I have a personal debt to Dr. Schwaber, but he can't take my promissory note and transfer it to somebody else because it's a personal relationship between the two of us, and therefore the existence of a market in promissory notes or the transfer of money by means of bills of exchange over long distances would be completely impossible according to Roman law and also according to Talmudic law. What Rav Hagaon has done here is to say that since all business depends upon the practices of the law merchant, which by the way was also in British law regarded as a completely separate body of law and not incorporated into standard British law until well into the 18th or 19th century, which now is known as commercial law. But for a long period of time, there was a body of law which was known as the law merchant, which was only applied to merchants and shippers and so on. And what Rav Hagaon has simply incorporated all of the law merchant as it deals with the existence of credit, capitalism as we know it today, into Talmudic law on the basis of just the fact that he was the presiding judge of the Jewish community and Jews were engaged in a widespread amount of commerce, and therefore it was necessary to change the commercial law of the Talmud to match the times, and that's exactly what he did. He says, in order that... if I don't change the law to make it match to what actual commercial activity is, business will come to a halt. Therefore, I decide that we're going to follow the Hakam al-Tajar, the law merchant, that's literal English translation is the law merchant, without adding or subtracting an iota. That's what he says. So it's an absolutely amazing tshuva. You find people discussing the notion of the Jewish law being more adaptable to credit based on the tshuva of the Rush, which was some 300 or 400 years later, and many scholarly articles on it. But here, this is an event that was taking place in the 10th or 11th century, and under the Islamic, in the Islamic world, and it's just absolutely amazing. Let me read to you what Professor Goitein has to say.
How would you have paid Dr. Schwaber? Was it a bag of gold? And what did they do before?
What they did before was that he collected money from me, either by, if it was a written contract for my property, he could put a lien on my property, or he would bring me into court and I would be forced to pay him. But he could not transfer the debt to you. I might have felt that, oh, Dr. Schwaber is a nice man and he's not going to be so troublesome if I'm a bit late on the payments, but I certainly don't want to be in debt to Mr. Weinstein, who's a hard, tough businessman who's going to collect all the time.
So how did they transfer that?
So there was no transfer of debt except for a very complicated system called Ma'amad Shlashtam. The three of us had to stand together, and it had to be understood that this personal obligation that I had to Dr. Schwaber was then transferred personally to you. But he could not transfer that without my agreement.
He needed witnesses.
That's right. So therefore, that's right. So if one needed, so in other words, under Roman law and under Talmudic law, debt was a personal obligation. What they teach in the yeshivas of Shibur HaGuf. My person is obligated to Dr. Schwaber. When he lent me that $100, he did me a favor, and I had a personal indebtedness to him, and that was not transferable except in, under a very complicated and cumbersome machinery. But obviously, if one is now dealing with shipping over from one country to another, and one has to be able to transfer credit and transfer money and exchange and even making the market in credit, all of that would be completely impossible according to both Talmudic law and according to Roman law, and eventually also according to ecumenical law. It was only because of the brilliance of someone like Rav Paigon, and even more importantly because of his centralized authority, that he was able to do this. So let me read to you what Professor Goitein has to say to that. Freedom of contract, the right of parties to choose the conditions that met their needs best, was the most conspicuous aspect of the law speaking to us through the Geniza records. This right applied in the first place to commerce, as when Jewish courts dealt most frequently with a partnership according to the Gentiles, that is, with a Muslim brand of a commando or the bills of exchange called the suftajah. It is true, he's now quoting this tshuva, writes a gone in reply to a query, that our sages have said that one should not send bills of exchange. But when we see that people actually use them, therefore we admit them in court, since otherwise commerce would come to a standstill and give judgment exactly in accordance with the law of the merchants. The marriage contracts, as well as other settlements made with regard to family life, also betray an amazing latitude of provisions and varieties of usage. And now I want to turn to that, because this is what we ended up with last time. So now let me first bring in a bit of the background to the next item that I want to study, which again so shows an amazing activity on the part of the Gaonim, which was rejected later on by the later authorities. The Gemara in Ketubot, Daf Samach Gimel, says, "Hamoredet al ba'ala," if a woman rebels against her husband, the Gemara interprets this to mean as refuses to have sex with her husband, "Hochatim la miktuva shiv'a dinarim b'shabbat," we deduct 7 dinarim from her ketubah each week. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Shivat Tarpaikan, 7 half dinarim. Ad matai hu pochek, how much you keep decreasing the value of her ketubah, ad keneged ketubata, until the entire value of the ketubah is used up. Rabbi Yossi Omer, la'olam hu pochek v'holech, you keep deducting money from her marriage contract, so in case that she gets an inheritance from some other source, he, the husband, can collect. And then the Gemara goes into some various discussions about what the law of Meredith is, and comes out finally with various completely unclear conclusion. The Rav Zvid's daughter-in-law rebelled against her husband. And Havat Fisa had Shira, she seized a certain amount of property and left the house and so on and so forth. And there's a discussion in the Gemara as to whether they ruled in favor of Rav Zvid, that is the family, the husband's family, or not. Hashta delo itma lo hachi velo hachi, tafsa lo mafkina mine, lo tafsa lo yhabina mine. And then the Gemara adds, "Umashahinen latresa yache shata agita," and then you wait 12 months until the get. That's all that we have in the language of the Gemara. So it's talking about a case where the woman wants out of a relationship, and what rights, what kind of property rights does she have, and doesn't she have? And now I want to examine how the Gaonim actually dealt with this question. So let's read from my page 3. This is from Dr. Kuczynski's work translated from German into Hebrew. Yes, there are plenty here. Chachmei HaTalmud, the Chachamim in the Talmud, horu kama hora'ot v'tiknu kama takanot v'din hamoreda. They enacted, they gave various rulings and enacted various laws as far as the Moreda is concerned. Hainu ha'isha ha'masarevet lichyot chaye ishut ba'ala. That is a woman who refuses to engage in a conjugal relationship with her husband. Lefi ha'achrona shebehem, apparently according to the last of their rulings, makabelet ha'moredet ki tarak la'achar yudbeis kodashim. The woman receives a get only after 12 months. Zehu ha'davar ha'yechidi ha'mitbarer lono mi'hatalmud gufo. This is the only clear thing that we can see from the language of the Gemara itself. Mechutz lezeh shum davar eino barur. Out of it, beyond the point that there is a waiting period of 12 months, nothing in the Talmud is clear. Ve'afilu ha'musag moredet eino kavua. Even the definition of what a notion of a moredet is not decided. Yeshnach machloket v'ta'anat ma'us alai im gamzu moredet. There's a dispute as to whether a woman who finds her husband physically repulsive and therefore refuses to have conjugal relationships, is she also called a moreda or not? Kein lo kava Talmud in mitan haget liachar yedbeis kodesh b'ritzon haba'al bilbad o ga'an bal kocho. It's not clear from the Talmudic language what happens after this 12-month waiting period. Is the husband compelled to give a divorce, or does he have, or can he refuse to give a divorce? Lo ba'al idei hacha'a זכות המורדת בכתובה המגיעה לכל אישה באופן חוקי, מתיים לבטולה ומאיה לאלמנה. Also, it's not clear from the Gemara what actually happens with the financial obligations in the ketubah, namely the normal 200 to the ketubah or 100 to the widow. וכן לא אחריו בגמר, מה מקבלת המורדת מנדונתה? What does she get from the her dowry, ומן המתנות שניתנו או הובטחו לו על ידי בעלה, or various gifts that were given or promised to her by the husband? ומה היא מפסדת מהן? And what does she lose? ונתבה הנוהל שזוכה היא במה שתפסה. Since this matter was unclear, whatever property she managed to seize, she kicks the husband out of the house and is holding on to the house, for example, one doesn't evict her, and all of this is not at all clear from the Gemara. תקנת הגאונים יוצרת בזה נורמה חוקית חדשה, שנה, שונה וקבועה. The enactments of the Gaonim on this matter have produced novel regulations which are different and clear cut. אלו הן המקורות מהן אנו שואבים את הידיעות על תקנה זו. מהלכות רבי יהודה הגאון, הגאון רבי יהודה מלך בישיבה צור הקרוב לשנת שבע. Rabbi Yehuda Gaon was the head of the Tzur Yeshiva around the year 760. And there's the following quote: "The Rabbeinu Aaron Kohen of Ilchot Dema Rabbi Yehuda Gaon dechi bay ita lugirushe shelo betzon barla." If a woman wants to get a divorce against the wishes of her husband, madchinan la yudbe yalchi b'gemar the afalti. You wait a 12-month period according to the Gemara to both that we just read. But now we do not follow the law of the Gemara. When the woman rebels against her husband and demands a divorce, we force the husband to give a divorce. And if he doesn't give a divorce, we put him in cherem until he actually produces the divorce. Aval kedei lemitva shalma bein ha'ish le'ishto, in order to have a possibility of some peace between a husband and wife, madchinen la'shat tavatavten. We wait a few weeks before forcing the husband to give a divorce under these circumstances. So this is an entirely different ruling, which is giving the wife, empowering the wife to compel the husband to give a divorce, something which is, according to modern current conceptions, completely against the spirit of Jewish law. Let's let's go to the Tshuva of Rav Shvira Gaon, which is our main source on this matter. So that's page 15 of the printed text, which is my page 5. Okay. Hasha'alim mevakshim lada'at im hadoreshet get mi ba'ala kemoredet. Is a woman who demands a divorce from her husband equivalent to what the Gemara calls a moredet? Ve'im ha'bal chayav liten l'klum me'ha'ktubah. And is the husband obligated to make any payments from the ktubah? Ha'meshiv Rav Shvira Gaon zal v'zum l'shana. Here's the language of Rav Shvira Gaon. Usha sha'al ten. Isha she'yoshevet tachat ba'ala. A woman who is married. Va'amra lo garsheni, and she says, give me a divorce. Eini rotza lishevimach. I do not want to live with you. Chayav liten la klum miktubata olo. Is he obligated to pay the ktuba or not? Kugon dav habimoredet olo. Is such a woman who demands a divorce from her husband to be treated according to what the Mishnah called the moredet? Hagaon mevaer kodem et hilchot ha-Talmud, kach ra'inu, sheshirat ha-din haita me'ikara, the original law was, she'ein mechayvin et ha-ba'al lagaresh et ishto in biksha gerushin, chutz mi'otan shamur v'atenu behen shekofin adon lahotzi. Except for the very specific cases where the husband is compelled to give a divorce, where he's become physically, if he's developed a horrible disease or has engaged in a particularly disgusting and foul occupation and so on. There are several instances in which the husband is compelled to give a divorce, but according to the Talmudic law, says Rav Shira Gaon, these are the only cases in which the husband is compelled to give a divorce. V'achar kach, but afterwards, hitkinu takana acheret, they made a separate enactment and another piece of legislation, sheyihu machrizin aleha arba'a shabbatot zu achar zu, that they would make an announcement every Shabbat one after the other, v'sholkin lo mebeitin habiyodat shafilu ktubatach meyama nahat ifsadet, that even the minimum amount of money in the ktubah you will lose if you persist in this way, v'tkinu shemeshahin oto kishetoba kerushim shneimasal chodesh shema yitaisu, that they wait for 1 year in order that they reach some kind of conciliation. V'im lo yipaisu v'achar shnei machsar chodesh kofin et ha-baal v'kotev l'get. So Rav Shvira Gaon is reading something into the Gemara that we don't see in the Gemara, namely that after this 12-month period, they force the husband to give a divorce. This is not clear in our text in the Gemara. Achar biur zem osif ha-gaon. But after the period of the Rabbanan Svara'i, kishera'u chachamim, shebenot Yisrael holchot v'nitlot v'gayim, v'itol lehen gittin me'ones mi'ba'aleihem, that the Jewish women turned to Gentiles to force the husbands to give a divorce, v'yesh kotvin get me'ones, and they sometimes bring physical coercion on the husband to write a get, umistapek get meusa b'din o shelo kavin, and then we have a problem as to whether this kind of a document, which has been forced by the husband on the basis of non-Jewish powerful people to give such a get, the kanafik mechurba, and a great amount of damage can come out of this situation. Takinu bimei mar baravraba umar bapuna noham eden. It was enacted in the period of Mar Bar Avava and Malapune, may they rest in paradise, l'moredet v'tovad gevushin, to a woman who demands a divorce, shekol nechsei tzon barzel sheechniso la mishalah mishalem, all of the money that the wife brought into the marriage, for which the husband undertook an ironclad obligation, that's the nechsei tzon barzel, he has to pay, v'afilu mach even those things which got worn out or were lost, he has to make good on. Umasha katavla alatzmo, and those things in which he promised, Masha lo matsui lo yushalem, la, what he has, he's not obligated to give in the divorce settlement, those things which he promised above and beyond those items. Umasha hu matsui nami achol gavda tfisa la mafkinen la, umahadrinen leila baal, and those matters which she sees from the monies that he brought into the marriage, they can get back from her and return to the husband. And they force the husband to issue a divorce immediately. And in addition, she gets the minimum payment that's in the ketubah, that is the 100 for a widow or divorcee, or the 200 for a tula. Ubezot anu mitnahagim hayom kishlosh meot shana v'yoter af atem asukim. This has been our practice for the last 300 years or more, and you are obligated to do that. So as the author here writes, these three texts we have with, are from Rav Shura Gaon, and indeed, if we take a look also in the letter of Rav Shira Gaon, the thing that we read last week, he mentions exactly when this particular item was enacted. He writes, V'achrav mar bar ababa shetiknu b'yamav latet altar get l'isha delo kishma'ate dakalta d'rav zvid, that they enacted in the time of Rav Abba, which was sometime in the 7th century, this rule that a woman can demand a divorce and the courts will compel the husband to give a divorce, in contrast to the story that we read in the Gemara to both about the daughter-in-law of Rav Zvi. So this was the, here's another clear example in which the Gaonim, on the basis of the events that were taking place in their time, namely women developing some kind of a women's rights movement and organizing and rebelling against the rule of Jewish law that only the husband on his own free will can issue a divorce, they enacted a piece of legislation which said that a wife can demand a divorce. The courts will then compel the husband to give a divorce. The wife retains all of her dowry that she brought into the marriage, plus the 100 and 200, but all the supplementary items in the ketubah contract, which the husband promised above and beyond the minimal payment, he is not obligated to pay, and she has to return if she sees them. So this is a rather amazing document. Let's...
Who does this compare to Islamic law?
I don't know the Islamic law. It's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it.
Presumably, the foreign law that the women were having recourse to was Islamic.
It's not clear that they were having recourse to a court, because as we just read, the Islamic courts would normally not interfere in Jewish communal practices. But they may have had access to various powerful figures within the Islamic community who would... Okay, let's read, in my handout I xeroxed something from the English translation of Professor Alon's book, so on his page 658, in English, the only thing in this handout which is in English. On the top. He writes, someone translated this into English, so it saves me a lot of effort. One of the significant enactments of the Gaonim is the Takana compelling a husband to give a divorce to a Meredit. The term Meredit and Mered, as defined in the Talmud and subsequent lore, signify refusal by the wife of the husband to live together conjugally. Various rules which were established concerning the granting of a divorce and the monetary rights in the case of a Moreda Moredet. In light of the changes in the social and moral climate in Babylonia, the Gaonim enacted at the beginning of the Gaonic period that a husband is compelled to deliver forthwith a divorce to a wife who is immarried. This enactment represented a substantial change in the essential nature and validity of the process of divorce, and subsequently gave rise to many disputes. The following is a brief review of the enactment and the debate to which it gave rise. A responsum of Rosh Hiragon, which appears in one of the sources dealing with this enactment, states, and we just read it, so we don't have to read that again, let's come to the next page. This responsum describes in detail the different stages of development of the law of Moreira. Under the law as it originally stood, her husband was not compelled to divorce her. This is not true according to Rav Shiragon's interpretation, as we saw. It was then enacted that the wife forfeits her ketubah and then she is given a warning, but that his husband was still not obligated to give her a divorce. Afterwards, a substantial change occurred. It was enacted that the wife had to wait for 12 months. If at the end of this cooling off period she still had not become reconciled with her husband, he was compelled to give her a divorce. That's according to Rav Shiragon. In the Gaonic period, this approach of compelling the husband to give a divorce reached its high point. Since women were then utilizing the pressure of the Muslim government to coerce their husbands to give them a divorce, it was feared that a divorce given after such pressure would likely be invalid because it would be in violation of the law forbidding coercion to compel the granting of a divorce. For this reason, the Gaonim enacted, the husband is immediately compelled by the Jewish court to divorce the Moreret, and this compulsion does not invalidate the divorce because the compulsion is effected pursuant to law. This enactment was still being adhered to at the end of the Gaonic period, both in Babylonia and elsewhere, and it was accepted by some halakhic authorities in the 12th and even the 13th century. However, there's evidence from the 12th century that the enactment had not been accepted by most Jewish communities. Let's read the Rambam on this, because before we proceed further, so let's take a look in the first page of my handout of the Rambam. So it's just after the English article. Ha'isha shemana ba'ala mitashmish hamita, a woman who refuses conjugal rights to her husband. Hi hanikret moreda. That woman is called a rebellious woman. V'sho'alinu otam mipnei ma morda. And she asked him, why do you refuse? Im amra ma'astihu ve'eini yicholah leiba'er lo mida'ati. If she says, I find him repulsive, and I cannot voluntarily have sex with him, kofin oto lahotzi l'sha'ato. We compel him to give a divorce. Lefi she'eina kishruya shetiba'el le'sanuila. A woman is not a slave in jail who should be compelled to have sex with someone who's hateful to her. Ve'teitze b'lo k'tuva klal. And she will leave the marriage without any ketuvah. V'titel b'lo otah kayamin bein min nechassim she'echnisa leba'alav v'nechayviu be'achrayotan bein min nechnasim she'lo nechayav be'achrayotan. And she will go back, retain her own property that she brought into the marriage. V'eina notelet mishel ba'al klum afilu min na'al she'baragleha u'mitpachat she'barosha she'lo kinla she'lo kranla poshetet v'notenet lo. All gifts that the husband gave to his wife were not based on the assumption that she would leave him. So therefore the Rambam makes two important decisions here. One is that a woman who claims that she cannot of her own free will have sex with her husband because she finds him hateful to her, a woman is not a slave to be to be coerced, and therefore the husband is compelled to give a divorce, but she loses all monetary obligations that the husband took upon himself, even except for those items which she brought into the marriage.
So she doesn't even get the mana of the marriage.
And she does not even get the mana umatari. So here, the Rambam has retreated somewhat from the Gaonic position. However, if she doesn't make the claim that her husband is physically or otherwise repulsive to her, but she's doing that in order to punish her husband. I'm doing this to get even with him because he did such and such, or because he used bad language with me, he cursed me, or because he had a fight with me. If that's the reason, she doesn't claim that she no longer loves her husband or finds him hateful or finds him repulsive, but she says she's just getting even with him. Shalchim la mi beit din v'yomrim la harei hadiyu da'at. You should know, she'im at omedet b'merdach afilu k'tubatach me'yam mana hifsarat ota. You will lose any value that you have in the k'tuba. V'yachar kach machrizin olav aleho b'batei knesiyot u'batei medreshot b'chol yom arba shabbatot zu achazu v'omrim plonit moredet al ba'ala. They make a public announcement for 4 weeks and claim that this woman has rebelled.